Warning, the following audio transmission is based on theory and is intended for entertainment purposes only. It's Doomsday and its affiliates will not be held liable for anything your dumbass does. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome, everybody, to It's Doomsday Podcast. Today is Sunday, January 4th. Time is 7 p.m., and joining me on the show today is Chris Weatherman, a.k.a. the Angry American. How are you, Chris?
Pretty good. How you doing today, man?
Good. You know, I'm sure the listeners are excited to hear the show because I went on social media and talked this all up. So I'm make sure it's good.
I hope they enjoy it, then.
So, Chris, you've accomplished a lot in the survival community. I went back on your bio on history.com and read through everything there. And I did catch something that said you spent time honing your skills in North Carolina a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's crazy because that's my home state. That's where I live is North Carolina. But your survival is – you've got bushcraft. You've got urban survival.
Yeah.
So I got to ask, what – that's not something you pick up one day and say, you know what, I'm going to be a survivalist, I'm going to be a prepper, I'm going to do these different things. What piqued your interest in survival? How did you get started? Where did the journey begin?
When I was a kid, you know, we lived in a very rural area, and the rules were, I mean, I'm talking when I was like 7 and 8 years old, the rules were pretty simple. Be back before dark. And beyond that, I was free to roam. So I'd grab a BB gun and a pocket knife and out the door I'd go in the mornings, and I was free to roam. I had, probably close to 200-acre patch that I roamed freely in, and there was bodies of water on it, so I'd fish and do stuff, and that's where I started kind of getting into primitive skills and teaching them to myself and reading books and learning about them, because it was in that same time frame I read the book My Side of the Mountain. And I wanted to run away from home and live inside a hollowed out oak tree so bad I couldn't stand it, you know. But so I started learning the skills that way. And it just kept kind of rolling, and, you know, from got into very much into the bushcraft thing for quite a while. And then I was living in Florida. That's where I grew up. That's where I live now. And hurricanes are a thing. So I've morphed into what I like to refer to as modern survival, of having the knowledge and the tools to be able to get through whatever may come. The knowledge being a big one. I think a lot of people forget that. They think they can buy their way into this, into survival. And in some cases you can, but, you know, you can find yourself with nothing to little. and that's where the knowledge comes in. You know, if you've got the knowledge, there's much you can do with it. So the tools help. Don't get me wrong. I love having all the tools, but, you know, having that mindset and skill set in place, and it's a bit of a comfort, you know, when you go out and you know that, really, no matter what happens, we're going to be okay. So we might not be comfortable, but we're going to be alive. And that's really what survival comes down to. Did you survive? Yes. Success.
Right. So, you know, and that's something I preach to the listeners a lot is you have to be actually practical with the stuff. You have to test your skills. You have to hone your skills.
Yes.
You have to do these things. And I mean, there's 1,000 examples of this, but like one in particular that pops in my mind, like when we're making a fire at the house, it is never with a lighter. It's always with a ferro rod.
There you go. Yeah.
It's only for the reason of keeping up with that skill and keeping mm-hmm. it going, you know?
Yeah.
But it was funny. You brought up, you know, I used to live in Florida. I lived in Florida for 10 years and we went through some nasty things down there with the hurricanes. And
yeah.
And I'll tell you what, it was always, you know, we always had what we needed as far as the survival aspect, but man, it's the other people. Like when the last hurricane hit, we were the only house on the street with power. And we're giving out ice to the neighbors because we were the only ones that could make ice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just watching everybody just be stuck twiddling their thumbs because they didn't know what to do without power for a week. And I'm over here like, we're fine.
Yeah.
Fridge works. We're doing laundry. We're good.
Yep. Yeah. I remember as a kid seeing the people that were lined up in their cars waiting for their gallon jug of water or their bag of ice at the National Guard or whoever's handing out. And I remember saying to myself then, I was like, I don't want to be those people. And so I've never been those people. I've never been in line for the handouts, you know. But you got to be careful because, like you said, when you're the only house that has power, we had somebody try to kick our front door in one night during a hurricane because we were the only thing with lights on around, is the only thing I could figure out. And
we tried hard.
So.
There's that, and a lot of people don't realize, though, when you have these extreme weather circumstances, they shut down first responders. 911 may not be working. So they're not dispatching EMS or police or fire out in the middle of a hurricane.
Well, even if it is working, yeah, they're going to hold everybody back until it's safe for them. They can't send people out to rescue others who are, let's say, didn't apply all of their common sense to the situation and put themselves in a worse predicament. It's really nobody's responsibility to risk their life to come save you. So that's another aspect of things that people kind of need to wrap their heads around.
Right. And so I'm an EMT. I'm a first responder. And one of the things that they drilled into us is scene safety.
Yep. Yep.
So you're not going to go out there and put yourself in harm's way at all.
No, not at all. What good are you? I mean, you know, I came up in heavy industrial electrical construction for a couple of decades and trained in confined space and high angle rescues and stuff like that. And particularly in confined space, it was drilled into our heads that typically the first rescuer is the second victim. And that stuck in my head. And we want to keep that scenario from replaying over and over and over in these, when something bad happens. So it's something I keep in mind, you know, first rescuer is often the second victim. So.
Right. And I don't want to dive too deep into this and go down a rabbit hole, but like one thing that the listeners need to understand is if there's a big event and it is a mass casualty incident event, all these first responders are going to be tied up dealing with that and not able to come help you. So the danger increases exponentially in a matter of moments.
Are you looking for something kick-ass to add to your closet? Reaper has the hookup for t-shirts, hoodies, button-ups, hats, beanies, and plenty of other badass products. You can check out Reaper Apparel Company at www.reaperapparelco.com and use code DOOM10 for 10% off. Jester only stands behind brands he believes in, and Dan at Reaper Apparel has a mission, and Jester is on board. Go check out www.reaperapparelco.com today and use code DOOM10 for 10% off your entire order. Why be a sheep when you can reap? Use code DOOM10 for 10% off at www.reaperapparelco.com today.
Oh, yeah. Just a flip of a switch. It's when we all become our own first responders immediately.
Yes.
In those situations.
Exactly.
And everybody should think of it that way. I am my own first responder because you'll be there when the bad thing happens if it happens to you. You know?
Right. And, you know, all right, let's get into the book series because I could talk about this stuff all day.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
All right. So I'm like trying to pick all these apart. So I'm popping up 22. You have a new book that just came out.
Yeah.
Right. But you have 22 different titles listed on Amazon.
Yeah.
Yep. And I got a man, I'll tell you what, I never wrote a book before, but I'm highly impressed with this. So the latest one, correct me if I'm wrong, is the Exploring Home book.
Correct. Yep. It's the 12th book in the Survivalist series, as it's technically called, but most people just refer to it as the Home series, the Going Home series. And it's the 12th installment in that. So the whole premise of that series is an EMP event. But bear in mind now, when I wrote that 2010, the only thing out was Patriots and One Second After, really. You had to dip back into like the 70s, William Johnstone Out of the Ashes to find kind of more reading in that genre. I think it was really me publishing that first book that kind of made the genre really explode the way it has in the last few years. Cause when everybody looked around and like, if that dumb redneck can do this, I can do this, which is fantastic. Cause it's created all kinds of content for that genre. And it's a voraciously consumed genre. People want to read it. They really like reading that stuff. So that's why we just keep putting them out.
Right. Know? And, you know, it's funny because being in the first responder realm, you meet a lot of other first responders. You start finding out a lot of these guys are preppers.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to God, that seems to be – I don't know why this is, but it's like everybody seems to be worried about the EMP.
Yeah, that's the big – because that's the big one. That's the one that, you know, everybody – just in the blink of an eye, we're back into the 1800s, you know. The same thing can be done with a cyber attack. People just don't realize how vulnerable we are. You know, we live in a glass castle, and right. And it's so fragile, you know, especially with my background in power generation, distribution, transmission, and all that. I really understand how vulnerable we are and the time frames involved to make repairs and things like that when stuff goes down. And the cyber end is my biggest concern right now, because it's so easy to pull off. Most of the equipment's made in China for as far as frequency drives and programmable logic controllers and stuff like that. And they routinely find the Chinese backdoor software in these things. So it's so easy for them to get into it and take it all down.
Right. And, you know, my big concern with the EMP is not so much losing everything, but what kind of chaos is going to be created. Because every time I think about the EMP hitting, I'm thinking about, we haven't experienced this before.
No.
So we don't know for sure what will all fail. We don't know what will all go down. Is it going to be a situation where vehicles are still up, but everything else is down? So everybody's mobile, but every security system's down, every surveillance system's down. So now you got people just running amok everywhere because they can, you know.
Well, the side of things that people forget with EMP, and I didn't even go into it in my books really either, is the amount of physical damage that would occur through an EMP. An EMP generates something like 83 volts per meter. And the more antenna you have, the more meters of antenna you have, the more load you pick up. So in during the Carrington event, you know, telegraph stations burned to the ground. There was so much load that came in there. And when that shorted and flashed, it set buildings on fire. So there would be a substantial amount of that taking place too. There would be a lot of stuff on fire. I mean, it would be a catastrophic event for that to occur.
You know, and I never thought into that either. I never thought.
Oh, yeah.
That.
Yeah. Telegraph wires took so much load that they overheated, drooped, and actually touched the ground. And there'd be wildfires. There would be, I mean, it would, the amount of damage that would be take place would be incredible. It wouldn't be, we're standing around and all of a sudden the lights went out and my phone doesn't work. I don't get that. What happened? You'd know something was happening. There's stuff would be arcing and sparking and fires in the skies. You know, power lines. I've seen power lines short together and what happens when they do that. And you don't have to wonder, is there something happening? It's going to be very obvious to you that something bad is going down right now.
Right, because I think a lot of people have that kind of mental depiction of, this is silent, nothing went wrong, it's like someone flicked a switch.
No, it's not going to be that way at all.
But, you know, in the back of my mind, I always thought, well, you know, there's capacitors and there's breakers. You're going to hear things clicking and clacking and popping and booming. You would have to.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and like breakers and capacitors, all those things are designed for a particular voltage range. You know, capacitors can handle so much amperage and only so much amperage. And I'll tell you, a capacitor explosion is a spectacular thing to witness. I've witnessed them. Transformer explosions are spectacular. I've seen them. The fires that they create are intense. You know, that say your average 750 kVA pad mount transformer behind the mall in your neighborhood, it's probably got 300 gallons of mineral oil inside of it. That's going to burn. It's flammable. So your 75 kVA transformer hanging on the pole in the backyard that feeds the power to your house, that's probably got 8 gallons of mineral oil in it, you know, and it's going to burn. So right. It'll be pretty obvious that something's going down. So
isn't that crazy what they put in there as a fuel?
Well, this actually the mineral oil is in there for cooling,
right?
Or not,
but it burns.
And, but it does burn.
That's
and
crazy.
It's also nasty stuff. It's not stuff you want to come in contact with. So,
just out of curiosity, when you're sitting there preparing for an EMP, just for the listeners, what would be your biggest advice you'd give somebody if they are prepping for an EMP? What do you want to have? What do you want to do?
Well, your basics, of course. You know, anytime we start talking about preparing for anything or picking a spot to potentially relocate this sort of things, the first thing we look at is water. So you've got to have your water storage on point, because, and not even storage, but a supply, because if you don't have water, you're going to leave where you are and go to it. That's just a fact.
Exactly.
And then the next thing is going to be, you know, shelter, fire, or energy. We cross that in either way, security, medical, the basic stuff. So, water is always number one, because humans, you know, we have to have water, and we are so heavily populated, especially in urban areas, that surface water is contaminated and it's useless unless you can purify it. So having your water plan on point is the first thing. People take it for granted, because, you know, most people have never had to go into the woods and source potable water that they can drink or to make water safe that they can drink. And they don't understand how labor intensive that can be. And most people don't even have the knowledge to do so. So things like dysentery and that kind of stuff will be commonplace. And two, people just not having clean water to drink is going to be a big problem.
So that's, you know, when I was buying my property that I live on now, like it was originally a bug out property, but now I live here full time.
There you go.
That was the biggest thing. I was hunting for a property with water. So I lucked out when I found this place. I've got two springs and a creek.
There you go.
The one spring, actually the head of it, I've piped in, and that supplies the whole house now.
Nice.
So that's great. In the event the pumps fail, I can go down there with a bucket and collect the water. In the event or I could run them off a generator if I needed to, if the power was completely dead, you know.
I'll put a ram pump in and push that stuff up there.
So I'll tell you what, I built a hydraulic ram pump by hand. I built a couple of these things, experimenting with them and playing with them. And I absolutely love these things. So I had two hydraulic ram pumps feeding three IBC totes I had plumbed together. And there's nothing to not like about them. The only thing I didn't like about them was the sediment I would get every time it would rain. And then this ram pump was 100 feet down, 300 feet away. And I'm moving at least 1,000 gallons a day with these things. They're amazing. And I found out, so number one, for anybody out there that's building these things, you want longevity, buy stainless valves.
Yes.
Buy stainless valves, not brass. The brass break down, they get weak, and they break down quickly. Get the stainless. And then what I found out was, and I didn't even know this till I really got into building these and playing with them, you can tune these things almost like an instrument for rate and flow. It's amazing. Just like 10 degrees this way, you're getting better flow, right?
Yep. Absolutely. Just a little bit.
Yeah. So I had these both feeding a half-inch line and feeding up to the house from the one spring. But, you know, I could still run these things, but it's like, you know what? I'm going to avoid the rain sediment. I'm going to pump from the other spring when I can. But we could always get those going again if need be, you know.
Yeah.
But, no, the hydraulic ram pumps are great, man. I absolutely love those things when it's not raining and I'm not getting the sediment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have enough food in your pantry for when disaster strikes? Go to www.readywise.com and utilize code DOOM10 for 10% off your entire food order. ReadyWise offers long-term food storage items such as chicken and beef that last up to 15 years. But that's not all. Go to www.readywise.com and use our code DOOM10 for 10% off of organic food as well. Offering chili, pasta, and soups, they have you covered. Did we mention they have fruits? Bananas, blueberries, strawberries, and apples, just to name a few. With many more food options for your home, car, or bug out bag, ReadyWise has your six. Go to www.readywise.com now and utilize code DOOM10 for 10% off.
But no, yeah, water is absolutely a big key thing. And we've have a few systems devised in order for filtering the water and making the water safe to drink. And I mean, the number one thing it comes down to is being able to store the water that you have clean, right? Because no one's going to be like, oh, I just boiled this for 30 minutes. Now it's drinkable. You're not going to sit there and drink that hot water. You need to store that for later. And then you also have to think, too, is, you know, you're not just using the water for drinking and making, like, the freeze-dried food and stuff like that. You also have to keep up with your hygiene. And you might need this. You might need clean water to treat a medical wound. And a lot of people, that just slips their mind.
Absolutely.
So don't think about it's just for drinking and eating. You're going to need to remain clean. You're going to need to clean a wound. You're going to need safe, clean water.
Yeah, you're going to need to be able to wash your hands, you know. You know, if you have a water source, you know, and if you have, particularly if you're on a septic system, you know, you can bucket brigade the toilets, you know, for the black side of things. You know, you can set up an outhouse to urinate in outside. That's great. But, you know, it gets a little inconvenient for kids and mom and stuff like that. And especially if you've got a, you know, cop a squat, it's easier to do that in the toilet and it be handled by the septic system than to try to do an outhouse. But if you're in a cul-de-sac community, where you're relying on lift stations and things like muffin monsters and stuff like that to push your waste from your community, you're going to be in a world of hurt. You know, I keep saying this to people, and it's like, if you live in a subdivision, I highly encourage you to find your sanitary sewer where it goes out to the street, dig up your yard, cut that thing, and put a gate valve in there so that if you are involved in a prolonged power outage, and I mean, you know, days to weeks or permanent, you can go out there and close that valve and it will prevent the waste from backing up from all your neighbors who are still flushing their toilets up the hill from you, from inundating your house. It will come up in your tub, toilet, sinks. It will flood your home.
Oh yeah.
And you will have to leave it. There's nothing you can do to stop it. But if you dig up that sanitary sewer and you put that valve in there, you can close it and that won't happen to your house. Now, it'll still happen to everybody around you. That neighborhood may become untenable. You might have to move anyway because all the other houses could be full of human waste. And that's just not going to be a sanitary situation, you know? So it's population density is not your friend, as my good buddy Alan Kay always says. And I firmly agree with that sentiment.
Oh, absolutely. I am so happy to be out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it. So I wanted to get into a little bit about you being on the Alone series and with the History Channel. I wanted to hear a little bit about that experience from you.
It was great. Actually, I met my buddy Alan Kay. He's up in North Georgia right now. He won the first season. We were on together, and he won that season. It was a fantastic experience because, in particular for us, it was a pure thing. We all went into it for the adventure and to test ourselves. And like, we were in Port Hardy, Vancouver. I think the day before they dropped us, actually, they told us there's a $500,000 prize at play. We didn't even know that was the case. We had no, we were all just going to do it. No prize ever even been mentioned. So the people that were there, most of them are great. There's one problem and person, but the rest of the people, they were fantastic. And there was no competition amongst us. Everybody, we all knew this. We were competing against ourselves. That's all we were competing against. And so, you know, we were the beta and we tried to help them refine their plans a little bit. And we did find the holes in their plans. And so things are a lot different now than they were back then. So that first season was pure. It really genuinely was. It was pretty amazing.
What were some of the biggest challenges you think you faced while you were out there?
Well, for me, it was a pack of wolves that didn't want to leave me alone. That's the second night that I was there. And that was what forced me out. They, you know, four timber wolves that just were too curious, wouldn't go away. But in Vancouver up there, you know, you're in a rainforest, you know, in 30 degree temperatures. So wet and cold much. Yeah, it was there. And for me, I was deployed via float plane and had to wade ashore like it was Normandy. I stepped off the float plane and sank into chest deep water and had to wade ashore. And I was the only person inserted that way too, which really made me mad. But that was tough because I never got dry. I was soaked the minute I got there, and I was never dry after that because I had my rain gear on and everything when I went in the water because I was anticipating getting ashore. Everything's wet. No, they made me wade ashore. So it was just, I was soaked right from the get-go. I was fortunate in that I had I had Wiggies make me a custom sleeping bag that was wider and longer than normal bags because I knew how much time I would probably be spending in it there. Because there's days where it just rained and rained, or, you know, you couldn't get out and could do anything. So just lay in your sleeping bag. And Wiggy's bags are, in particular, are super good at drying you out. So the first night that I slept, I just stayed in my clothes and got in the bag. And by the morning, the only thing still wet on me was the cuff around the bottom of my pants and a little bit around my waist, and everything else was dry.
Huh.
The bag dried me out overnight.
That's wild. It retains it retains that much of your body heat that's just drying everything out? Wow.
Well, that and it allows the water vapor to pass through the bag and out. So like the tarp I was under had water all over the bottom of it in the morning, you know, the condensation essentially, what didn't blow out of there. But yeah, that bag was impressive.
Yeah, God, that'd be a horrible way to start that. In the water and then 30 degree nights? Nah, I'm good. I'll stay home.
Yeah, and the wind and the darkness too. Like it's hard to really, you know, convey that level of dark. It was like being underground dark. Like there's no man-made lights. The cloud cover was so thick you couldn't see the moon or stars. And so it was pitch, utter blackness. Like it'd give you vertigo even, like not being accustomed to it. So it was rough. I would come out of my hooch at night. I had a ridge pole leaned against a great big, enormous spruce tree. That thing was probably 10, 12 feet in diameter around, you know. And I would come out of there at night and put my hand on the tree and walk around it to take a leak. And then I would put my hand back on the tree and walk back around it until I bumped into my ridge pole. And that's how I knew if I let go, I'd lose it, never find it.
Wow. So utter, just total pitch black.
Complete and utter. I would lay in my bed at night and like I'd go, oh, there it is. It's right there. Yeah, I didn't see it. Yeah. Oh, there it is. Yeah, I didn't still see it.
That is wild. So would you do it again though?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, yes, I would. I would do it again. But these days, writing books is a lot easier way to make money. But I would still go. They actually asked me during the Mongolia season. They asked me if I'd go, and I said, "Yeah, put me on the list. If you guys need somebody, I'll go." So,
right.
Want to be a guest on the show? Email itsdoomsdaypodcast@gmail.com. That's itsdoomsdaypodcast@gmail.com.
So, Chris, tell me about your new website, angryamerican.com.
Yeah, that's your usual, where you can find all the socials, the links to all the different things. There's a events tab, I think, coming. I don't think that one's on there just yet because the site's still, it's fairly new. And so that what you see is the first phase. Second phase is coming, and there'll even be a third phase to it. So it's all being built. There'll end up being a forum on there. But all the books are listed there. There's a store on there where you can buy some swag and some other things that are coming. We have some blades that will be going into production this year.
You guys are going to start making your own knives.
Yeah, we've got some designs. Alan here and a buddy of mine, Donnie, and me, we designed one that we call the Dalton. And it's a modified kukri, kind of a one-tool solution. And then there's going to be a smaller, sort of just a field knife, very simple drop points design. I'm a big fan of that blade profile. And so those are the first two that are coming out. They're going to be made by Kyle Gahagan, actually, is who's making our knives.
Gotcha. And so all your books are listed on the website, I'm seeing.
Yes, they are.
So with your book series, when people ask you questions about it, is it a thing where they can just pick up any book and start reading it, or do you need to start with a certain one? What do you prefer people do?
You really need to start at the beginning. Okay. Because, you know, this series is extremely linear. So one book follows another, immediately, where one ends, the next one picks up at exactly that spot. So they're very linear. Right now we're in 12 books, and timeline-wise in the event in the world, it's only just over a year of actual time that's passed. So each book's kind of almost like a month in occurrence, basically. So, you know, and you get the character development really in the first couple, three books is where most of the primary characters are in at that point. And they stick around, and it amazes me when people send me messages like, "Hey man, when's the next book coming out? Because I'm worried about my friends. You know, I want to make sure they're okay."
Awesome. So that's really cool. So the readers are connecting really well with the characters.
That's what they tell me. You know, that's one of the things I get complimented on a lot is the character development. Because you know, every book has the word home in the title, because that's the essence of this entire story of what is home and the characters in the book. And they say it themselves at times in there that they're one big family, and they're family by choice, you know, which a lot of times can be better than your actual family, you know, when you get to pick them.
Yes.
So, and they're all 100% dedicated to one another, and they'll do anything for each other.
Right. And I mean, they're in this post-apocalyptic setting, right? So, I mean, when you're in that setting, you really got to trust those people. So I could see how people could connect with that.
Yeah. And, you know, and the fact that, you know, for all of us, the idea of building a team or building a network or a tribe, call it what you want, you know, that's one of the most difficult things you'll ever do, because there are so many critically important aspects of it, you know, of selecting people. And Alan and I wrote a book here called Decline and Decay, Strategies for Surviving the Coming Unpleasantness. And in there, we have a chapter called Pressure Testing. And it's about pressure testing ourselves, pressure testing our equipment, and pressure testing those we are going to rely on when the bad things happen. Because you're going to have to lay down and close your eyes and go to sleep at some point. And you got to know that the people that are standing up, that are, you know, watch over you, are going to be there and do the job, you know. Because you can't have any half measures in that regard. You know, I got to go to sleep and I got to make sure my family's okay. But, you know, I watched yours last night. You got to watch mine tonight so I can go to sleep. So it's just too important.
So we've covered that a lot on the show, actually, like, you know, group selection, survival group selection. Mm-hmm. And there are so many factors that people do not think about.
No.
You could have this one guy. He appears to be fine. He's awesome at everything. But you might not know that he's on antipsychotics, and then shit hits the fan, and that supply gets cut off, and he's a totally different dude.
Yeah.
You know, vetting is key.
It could even be something as simple as, like, I'll give you an example from the Alone Show. Before we went out, they sent us to upstate New York to a place called Bear Mountain, where we did a boot camp, essentially. There's 20 guys. And these are all survivalists, you know, that are going to be tested. And the very first night we were there, we had a guy just absolutely lose his mind over mosquitoes. Like, the first night, like, we had just got there, and this one guy's already going completely apeshit over mosquitoes. And we're like, bro, like, how much time have you spent in the woods, man? You know, you're going to have that. And you should have ways to mitigate it. But you know, you don't want to find out, you know, when you're in a critical moment and you're relying on others that you've got some people that for whatever reason can't hack it. You might find out that Larry really cannot function in cold. He's just one of those guys that maybe can't handle it, you know, and kind of loses his mind. Just like something over mosquitoes. And another thing too was chow in that incident. Like we had all the food we wanted, and they're like, you're adults, you can eat what you want. Same guy. The following morning was like, you know, they're like, all right, let's get up, we're gonna start moving. And this one guy's like, well, I haven't had my breakfast yet. And they're like, that's not our problem. And they're like, well, you said we could eat whenever we want. He's like, yeah, and you could have, except now you have something to go do. And seeing those little conflicts in character, and then too the interpersonal relationships that have to be developed in a group. Everybody's got to kind of get along. You know, if you've got two people that are really butting heads, it's eventually going to be a problem. And so you got to, you know, mitigate that.
Right. And you're talking about, you know, these situations escalating when there might not be any hope and you might be in a lawless society.
Yeah. I mean, where words carry weight and people are armed and they know there's no, you know, law enforcement consequences to their actions. There could be, you know, obviously swift retribution from other members of a group.
Right.
And that could be aimed at you just as easy as it is aimed at someone else. So you've got to be extremely careful, you know. When the rule of law is essentially up to the individual, you know, you've got to hope you've got some people that are with some very grounded morals.
Yes.
That will do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. So you said the magic A word, armed. And I got to ask you, this is something I try to get out of every prepper and survivalist.
Sure.
Preferred caliber for the apocalypse.
It's going to be 5.56 for me.
Really?
Yeah.
So my default is always 22 LR.
Yeah.
And there's multiple reasons for it, but the main one is how cheaply you can stock this.
Absolutely. I've got 33,000, I think.
Right.
22 long rifle. So.
Yeah. And just the applications for it are endless. You know, grocery shopping in the woods or defensive purposes, it'll do the job.
It'll do the job. For me, there's so many other ways I can acquire calories through trapping, primitive trapping at that, that hunting isn't high on my list. Besides, hunting is the most energy inefficient endeavor one can engage in. You know, I can go out in a day and set 25 traps, and then now I've got something that all I got to do is take a walk over an hour and check my traps and come back home instead of being out in the woods all day trying to hunt some critters down. And when the bad thing does happen, you know, the amount of game available will dwindle rapidly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is, again, is something we cover in Decline and Decay, was that in the early 1900s, white-tailed deer were nearly extirpated from the eastern United States. East of the Mississippi, white-tailed deer hardly existed. Like, it was something to talk about if you saw one. And if you look at our population density then compared to now, you know, and the number of people who think I'm just going to run to the woods and feed my family.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that do have that mentality.
The woods, you know, I tell people all the time, the woods are going to look like the Oregon Trail scattered with kit, you know. It's going to be everywhere because people are going to have stuff that they've been carrying and they're going to throw it down. And I'm not going to carry this thing no more. And that's where pressure testing comes in. You should already know what you can carry and what you can't carry. You should know what you need, what you don't need. If you're, you know, we do classes at times and we'll do ruck inspections and it kind of cracks me up when people start unloading their bag and everything's still in the package and still in the wrapper. And I'm like, have you never tried to use this stuff? I'm like, you built this kit thinking that someday your life may depend on it. And yet you've never taken this out of the bag or the package to even see what it does, how it does it, and if you can do it. So that's something that always kind of breaks my heart a little bit. I'm like, these folks think that they're doing the right thing, and they are doing the right thing. But the more important thing is to get out there and do it. But to get out there and do it means they got to get uncomfortable. and people don't like to be uncomfortable, which is another point I stress often. Start getting comfortable with being uncomfortable so that the transition won't be as hard on you later as it will be for most who are just going to suddenly be thrust into it and have to deal with it.
See, and that's, you know, and I'm not blanketing the entire American population, but something that I have noticed in recent years in getting out more in society, you know, doing the first responder thing and meeting more people and doing what I do now, I'm really worried that most of these people won't survive as soon as the grocery stores close, McDonald's gets shut down. Like, I can't see most Americans making it to the woods to rent. No. I can't see most of them getting off the couch.
Fire is one of the most basic essentials for survival. Whether you're camping, hiking, or preparing for disaster, Blackbeard has your six. Go to www.blackbeardfire.com and utilize code Doomsday for 10% off your entire purchase. Blackbeard offers stormproof matches, plasma arc lighters, fire starters, and ferro rods, all of which are great for your bug out bag. Once again, go to www.blackbeardfire.com and utilize code Doomsday for 10% off your entire purchase.
Well, they will when they're forced to, but and that's just it. They're not going to do it until they're absolutely forced to do it. Because, you know, going back to water, that's the thing that's going to drive millions of people out of their homes. I mean, you know, your cul-de-sac community might have a retention pond in it someplace, but everybody in there is going to be using it. And not everybody knows how to handle their waste, you know, in lieu of a sanitary sewer system. Most people have no idea what to do with it.
Right.
And you could be doing everything right, but if your neighbor's not handling his correctly, you're probably going to get sick from it. So it's a hard task to take, and people don't really grasp the enormity of the situation. And water is just the one thing. I mean, and that was huge. That's not even getting into the other stuff. Water is your number one thing.
Right. And it's just, I have a lot of these conversations with people about, you know, upcoming things and what they could be doing and what they should be doing different. And so many people are turning a blind eye to this. And it's crazy because, like, the area I live in, you wouldn't believe, like, we own a restaurant in town, and you wouldn't believe how many people come there for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and don't do any cooking at home, mm-hmm. have nothing in the pantry. And, I mean, hunger is a big motivator for people.
And starts more revolutions than anything else does.
Right. And what worries me is it's not going to be so much are you going to starve to death as much as you're going to have the security situation to deal with, because this guy's wanting to kill you for a can of beans, you know, because he's starving to death. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so let's – I don't want to go down too big of a rabbit hole.
I use that exact example, except it was a can of corn in my books where a guy gets killed over a can of corn. And it was a guy with a wife and a child, and he was killed by a single guy that didn't have a can of corn.
So
but that guy happened.
Let's pull this back in, because I want to – because we are coming up on our time from here. I want to pull in all your social media links, where everybody could find you out online, because I know you're big on the YouTube.
Yeah, I do YouTube and Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, we're on Rumble. I don't even remember all of them. I finally signed with a manager a couple of years ago, and she's changing things dramatically and doing a fantastic job. I wish I'd done it sooner, not waited the 2 years from her initial contact. So I'm available everywhere. I answer all my own questions. You know, if you send me a message, I'm the guy that's going to answer it. So I'm real active on Twitter because it's so much easier. Facebook gets into a bit of a bog in my mind, and so I do it, but not nearly as much as I do Twitter. So yeah, any of them, you can find them anywhere. The books are all available on Amazon, best place, audible.com for audiobooks. But you can also buy on from my store, you can buy signed copies of books, that kind of thing. So
what, anything new up and coming, any big things on the horizon?
Well, we're trying, this project is fully developed for a streaming platform. So we're trying to take the going home story to the screen.
Oh, and, awesome. Very cool.
Well, I've been working on that project for over 6 years at this point. And I've been to LA. I've taken meetings with big studios everybody knows. And sadly, I've had to look at those people in every instance and say no and stand up and walk out of the room because of just what Hollywood wants to do, which is what Hollywood always does, is ruin a project.
Yep.
So, so we're trying to find the right people. And I took a meeting yesterday with somebody that, that might be able to assist me in this, and he's going to see what he can do, because there's, you know, there's a big movement recently and what I'll call conservative entertainment, not the traditional Hollywood route. And so there's some things happening on that side. It's just wonderful to see finally. So maybe we'll get some traction there. We'll find out.
Yeah, that'd be awesome if it was turned into a series.
Oh, yeah, I want it to so bad, but I just want it done correctly. I'm not willing to just sell it to a studio and walk away and let them take it and butcher it and turn it into something that's not at all what it was. Because, I mean, literally, I was sitting in MGM Studios talking to the president of MGM, and I said, look, man, nobody wants your version of this story. They just want this story. I'm like, if you'll do that, you guys will do great. But they just kept talking crazy stuff, and I was just finally like, no, not doing it.
So, I mean, also, you wrote this series, though. This is like a child. This is your baby.
Yeah, and it happened completely by accident, too. None of this was ever intentional. I wrote Going Home on an internet forum for my own personal entertainment. I at the time, I was doing the security platforms in jails and prisons all over the country, and I spent a lot of time in hotels, and I don't like to hang out in bars, you know, or nothing like that. So I'd sit in a hotel room and write this story, and just from there, from that one little spot on the internet, I had over 2 million views online before I ever published it.
Wow.
It exploded. Like, it was like, really, it was like a nuclear charge going off in the genre when this stuff started, because it changed everything. And I'm not saying that like, oh, I'm that guy, but that's what happened. That's just a fact. You right. Go back and look at published dates and see who published what when and tell kind of where the change happened. So.
Gotcha. So, I did hear you mention something. You're doing classes and stuff like that. Do you go out and do events? Are you doing any like the prepper events that are going
on? Yeah, I've got one coming up. I'm going to be in at the Bushcraft Preparedness Homesteading Expo in Kentucky in March 15th, 16th, and 17th. It's in it's up near Laverne, Kentucky. We will be at that one. And then there's a smaller event on the 23rd in Kentucky we'll be at. So we'll be doing those for sure. And then I will post on events, you know, as they're coming up, we post where we're going to be. We always let everybody know where we're traveling. And I'm the kind of guy that when I'm there, if you want to go out to dinner, let's go. I don't care if it's just one person or 10, let's go out. We'll sit down and talk. We'll have dinner and let's hash things out. You know,
that's awesome.
I'm always willing to answer questions. If someone's trying to figure something out, or if I don't know, I probably know somebody who does know, and I'll put you in touch with them. So yeah, I like the networking and sharing the knowledge base is something that we're always trying to do, you know.
Well, so in this weird preparedness survivalist realm, I have so many people that ask me questions, and they always ask questions I don't have the answer for. So I find myself learning consistently, mm-hmm. all the time, learning something new. And yeah. There's very few people I meet where I'm like, this guy's got it all figured out.
Nobody's got it all figured out.
Right. But you know what? I always come in contact with people that definitely know more than I do.
Absolutely.
That happens all the time.
Every day. Every day.
So it's awesome. But Chris, hey, I want to thank you for coming on the show. And for my listeners out there, find Chris on YouTube, find his website, pretty much the Angry American on everything, right?
Yeah. You put that in anywhere and pretty much, and I show up. So that's my handle. And that, again, just that name, even that was my username. My screen name on the forum where I wrote the book, and it just stuck to me because nobody knew my name.
Right.
So I had fun with that, and that's how I'm still known. So, and that's fine with me. I'm because I am a pretty angry American. So.
This is an emergency action message. At approximately 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, NORA is tracking 15 ICBM nuclear missiles inbound to the following cities: Orlando, Miami, Pittsburgh, Dover, Newark, Richland, Philadelphia, New York City, Baltimore, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Boston, Seattle, Detroit. This is an extremely deadly situation. Stay tuned, the next emergency message will be a presidential address.